Hi! This is Bobcat Goldthwait, and you're listening to Subspace Transmissions!
I'm sorry I'm late. I was watching The First Enterprise on the holodeck. You know, Archer and those guys?
What a story. Those guys had a long road getting from there to here.
Course set for the Tal'Ganna system, Captain, awaiting your command.
Ah, Tal'Ganna 4. You know, they have a little Risa.
Oh, so then should we take the little Horgan?
No.
Let's take the one we always use.
Ahem.
Right, give me warp!
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on Madman Riker's Bridge...
Well, this is Tyler Orton coming in at you at warp factor 5, 6, 7, 8.
And we're here this week to talk about the finale of season 1, Lower Decks, No Small Parts.
Cam, let's not bury the lead here. We were talking a lot about legacy characters that might make a return. We got it with Riker and Troy aboard the USS Titan shortly after Star Trek Nemesis had wrapped up. Cam, did this work for you? Did this legacy appearance of two beloved characters work for you?
I mean, I thought it was amazing. I can't wait to dive into the actual content of the appearance, but I feel like it was dulled a little bit by having Riker show up in the finale of Picard. It was kind of like seeing the same thing twice. You know what I mean?
Oh, I get what you're saying. You know, like he comes to the rescue again and again. He's been there. But let's just be honest. Jonathan Frakes is the, and I use that in like scare quotes right there, he is the legacy character of Star Trek at this point, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. You know, you'd think it could be Kirk, but William Shatner hasn't worked on Star Trek forever. So, yeah, I guess like Riker has become the de facto character they are going to in at least the Kurtzman era.
Well, even the Berman era, he was in Star Trek Voyager. He was in Star Trek Enterprise, which they referenced in this with, Deanna, I was just hanging out with the Enterprise crew on the holodeck again, you know? Could you ever imagine? Okay, if there's one show to do it, of course, you could make fun of Where My Heart Will Take Me, aka Faith of the Heart. But it, like, I'm so glad they actually made fun of that song in Star Trek Lower Decks.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when he dropped that Enterprise reference, I just was like, this is gold. And I loved why this worked for me, though. I mean, yes, the surprise or sort of the shock factor was a little dulled by because of Picard. But I loved that they played it really as Madman Riker. Like, it felt like the caricature of Riker that Jonathan Frakes has wanted to do for years and finally burst forth in wonderful glory.
Well, let me ask you this. Was this... Riker, or was this Jonathan Frakes? We've had this question before on the show.
This was Jonathan Frakes during his convention panels, just going insane on stage. Like, I love that this show allows him to do that with Riker, because can you imagine if Nepente Riker had been like this?
That'd be amazing. He's running up to like Picard and like holding him in his arms and swinging him around, going like, Jean-Luc, good to see you again.
I guess the closest we got was him doing his red alert in Nepente. Like, that was pretty good too.
Yeah. And for people that are curious, go see, you know, one Jonathan Frakes at convention. Cam, remember a couple years ago, he literally sat in our row, and I'm not talking about like at the end of the row. He was what, like three seats away from us, just to like troll Marina Sirtis with the microphone, because she had no idea where he was sitting within the audience.
Oh, that was incredible. My favorite appearance though that we went to, I think though, was the year in Seattle, where he was like laying on the stage. And I remember Fallen co-host Benjamin Yong, I believe, showed up late. He was driving in from Vancouver. Tyler and I had been there for both days of the Seattle Star Trek convention. Ben Yong was just crashing in on the last day. And he walked into that panel and was just like, what is going on?
He was laying on his back on stage and he was taking a phone call as well.
And then he found the moderator's notes and just started reading them out and making fun of the moderator. Like,
it was Richard Arnold, who was Gene Roddenberry's former assistant. And he was like, what, like in his like 20s when he was Gene Roddenberry's assistant back in the 1980s. So I think Jonathan Frakes always just thought of him as kind of the boy wonder, and him mocking Richard Arnold's notes on stage was pretty hilarious as well. I don't know. And the cam that also gave way to the best photo op you and I have ever done in our entire lives, in which we both embarrassed ourselves in front of Jonathan Frakes, and our guts were splitting in laughter after we took a look at the photo a couple hours later.
And at that point, we hadn't really seen Jonathan Frakes do panels very much. I think I had seen him, I guess, a couple times in Vegas, but I don't know. Like, I felt like I didn't have a good sense still of his presence at these conventions. And so, like, walking away from that and looking back on it now, I'm like, boy, we really made fools of ourselves in front of the right Star Trek celeb.
Yes, yes. I have no regrets over that photo op there. But maybe into the whole meat of it, though. The actual appearance of, you know, Riker and Troy, I know it seems like, you know, a cynical fan service sort of moment. It's stuff that if I'm watching a show like Sopranos and Robert De Niro pops in at the end and shoots everybody up and resolves the season long arc that way, I would be annoyed. I don't care, Cam. Like, this worked for me. It was funny. It was just exhilarating to see the Titan on screen, have our kind of imagination kind of fill in a lot of those blank spots that we didn't really have going forward after Riker took command of the Titan.
Yeah, we've never gotten to see Riker aboard the Titan. We got kind of the beforehand, and then we got the after. And it's like, this, we finally got our first real glimpse of that. I know that there's countless novels and comic books and all that that chart the course of Riker's journey and with Troy on the Titan, but this is the first time in canon Star Trek we've really gotten a really good portrait of him on the bridge, acting apparently like a lunatic.
Well, finding out that he's the one that supplies Mariner with all her contraband, and Troy's like, we're going to have to talk about that later. I mean, like, those are moments that I love watching.
I loved the bit with the two of them talking about the Horrigan they were going to take to Risa.
Oh, just the little one, right?
No, the regular one.
Okay. Well, because they weren't actually going to Risa, though, right?
I don't think so. I think, didn't he say it's like Risa or
yeah,
something?
And I think that's why she suggested they take the little Horrigan in this situation. So,
right.
I know the cynical fan inside me just kind of rolls my eyes, but I don't care, because these moments, brought me joy. I laughed. And if this is a comedy series, that's what it needs to do.
Well, and also a show like Lower Decks is doing what I guess the other Star Trek shows, I guess they have dabbled in it at this point, but the whole shared universe concept of Star Trek, when you're doing, say, 7 of 9 on Picard, a lot of explaining has to go into this for it to work. You know, because those two don't have a relationship. And so, you know, you've got to have, you got to build that up so it all makes sense. But in an animated world, in a 25 minute, you know, sitcom, you can really exploit this whole shared universe concept very simply in ways that, you know, you don't have to do excessive, explanation as to what's going on.
It would be like how we debated whether you could integrate Sela into the Dominion War somehow, and then we both realized, well, you'd have to sit there every single time she appears on screen, you'd have to do all this like exposition, and just kind of get in the way of enjoying what's going on.
And also, you know, we talked about Sela in Nemesis and just how that would never happen. And so, you know, they create this original character Shinzon because that's so much easier to explain than a character with backstory like Sela.
Wait, are you saying that Denise Crosby was up for the role of Bane?
Hello, Armist. I will die at your hands one of these days, but I shall have my progeny seek vengeance on you, Armist.
You merely inhabit the TARDIS. I was born in it.
Well, let me also spell this out. After these two spinoffs of Star Trek that we've gotten in the Kurtzman era, the third one, Star Trek Lower Decks, is the one that really captures the funness of the universe more so than anything else. And I know it's a comedy, but I just, I, it, it doesn't feel as if Star Trek's been this fun since I was watching season 4 of Enterprise, where they're just playing within the mythology of the universe so well, especially in episodes like In a Mirror Darkly.
I'll make a bit of an argument, though, for the J.J. Abrams films, especially the
first one. Yeah.
Which I did think touched on, and you know what, Beyond as well, touching on some of the TOS tropes in a way that felt kind of lighthearted and fun. But in terms of TV Star Trek, you're 100% right. Yeah. What I have loved really about this episode is even ways like the opening set with, you know, Beta 3 and Landru from Return of the Archons.
Yes.
Incredible. Like, believe me, you could have ended the episode after that opening and I would have walked away loving the, you know, season finale. Like, someone who loves TOS so much, I was just over the moon. But, you know, take away the jokes, even then I found that Return to Beta 3 so much fun to watch. And that's something that a lot of, you know, I feel like if Picard went to Beta 3, it would not be fun.
No, not at all. That scythe would be used to chop off someone's head, right? If this is Star Trek Picard.
Yes, and there would just be a lot of very grim morality going on.
Yeah. But it also kind of brings up a good question. This is something they do touch on, especially with Freeman's journey throughout this episode. And I should say that all the characters get a lot to do throughout this episode. And keeping it balanced, I thought it was an amazing way to kind of wrap up a season. But with regards to what Freeman's pushing out there, though, is like the idea of like Starfleet protocols. Does a Prime Directive even make any sense? And this idea of coming back to what Freeman called legacy civilizations and like, okay, well, Starfleet did its thing, you know, 100 years ago. But what happens after that? And I think inevitably, and I think it's actually kind of a profound statement that maybe Lower Decks is making, though, is that societies can regress. Societies can fall back into patterns, much like individuals do. And I think just because you've got like an iconic episode that is telling us very important things, it doesn't mean as if everything is going to be solved for said society for the next generation to come.
One, they also talk about how Starfleet is better at observing than maintaining. And yes. I thought that was also very telling. I mean, Tyler, this half-hour sitcom, I feel like, had a more profound statement to make on the universe of Star Trek than the finale of Picard. And I'll give you both parts of the finale of Picard.
What did the finale of Picard have to say about the morality or the state of the Star Trek universe, Cam?
Nothing. I mean, what it gave us was stuff, character moments with Data and Picard, which, you know, were valuable.
Yeah.
But in terms of the larger universe of Star Trek, it didn't really have anything that profound to say.
And our issue with Discovery, which you and I both like Star Trek Discovery more than we do Star Trek Picard, but our issue with Discovery is that it's too often like tell, don't show. In that we have Burnham, she often will do these soliloquies and they all come down to, we are Starfleet. We have values. The Federation are the people. And it's just like, well, what does any of this even mean? It's just kind of like nonsense gibberish where it's like you don't want to stake a claim on any sort of real world view other than just sharing what amounts to just platitudes.
Do you think it's because in these live action shows, they're scared of ruffling the feathers of fans, whereas in a animated sitcom that is satirizing Star Trek in many ways, they have the freedom to do these things?
I think that's part of it. But you are correct. Like I think there is more freedom going on with regards to what they can do and get away with in Star Trek Lower Decks. But the thing is, it's so easy for Burnham to talk about like what these values of the Federation represents in a much more tangible, much firmer way. I know they've said things like, we believe in equality. Wow. That's a very daring position to have nowadays. You believe in equality. Well, why don't you go further and try to really wrap it in to just this very fractured state that we have in society across the globe where things are becoming more polarized? Be daring. Gene Roddenberry put a Russian aboard the Enterprise in the middle of the Cold War, you know, that sort of stuff. So I just want the shows to be more daring, but not in a way where they think daring means more violent or dropping F-bombs. Like, that's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I mean, I appreciate, you know, Star Trek bringing a transgendered character into Star Trek Discovery. It feels like that should have been done a few years ago, but at least they're doing it. And you know, why can't Star Trek keep making strides forward? It seems like once Star Trek became popular, they just got kind of scared. where it's like, okay, we want to be progressive, but not too progressive, which is how you wind up with a moment with like the Sulu and his husband in Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah, where they pat each other on the back.
As all couples do.
Yeah.
I like that they took out the high five. That might have been a little too much, Tyler.
Okay, fair enough. I high five my girlfriend every once in a while, so I'll say
exactly.
Okay. So, yeah, but look, Lower Decks, for me, it feels as if it's really tapped into Star Trek and just the spirit of Star Trek, I should say, in a way that we have not gotten through the previous three seasons that we watched over the last couple of years, starting in 2017.
It's really hard to verbalize sometimes too what that means. Like, it feels like Star Trek, but you know it when it's happening. Because for me, you know, once the Paclids had shown up in this episode, and we had, you know, the ship under siege, and we had going through the motions of how they were going to, you know, resolve the problem, it felt like I was watching a really good episode of TNG, for example, or Voyager, what have you. And yet, you know, obviously the comedy's there, but the storytelling felt like classic Star Trek. And you connect with it emotionally in a way that maybe you can't even logically explain. Like, I don't know that I could explain to you exactly why it feels like Star Trek, whereas, you know, some of the episodes of Picard don't, or some of the weaker episodes of Discovery.
Yeah, and you've brought it up many a time that maybe Star Trek Discovery just has that significant edge over Picard because of the way that you connect to the characters versus the supporting cast of Picard, which has some characters that I like, but I just have not connected to them the same way. But with Lower Decks, you know, I'm just thinking about like a character like Tendi, who her entire arc is about how she's not jealous of the exocomp. You know, that's a peanut hamper, as we know her. that's the sort of earnestness that I like. It's like you can root for these characters. Watching Rutherford's journey throughout this and seeing him lose his long-term memory, and again, Tendi's reaction is, oh, that's awesome. We get to learn how to be best friends again. Like, it's really heartwarming to see this sort of stuff.
Well, it has the positivity you like in Star Trek, too. You know, I think of so many episodes of the original series. Well, there'll be some, you know, serious drama, but at the end, they're joking with Spock and McCoy on the bridge or something, or they're all laughing, or it feels kind of like a family, you know, blowing off steam at the end of a mission. And I like that we get that here, where, you know, very grim things have happened. Shaxx has been killed, but the characters, I mean, their lives are going to go on, and they're still friends, and they matter to each other.
Yeah. So, moving forward with maybe kind of our review of the episode overall, maybe a little nitpick, but again, it deals with an alien invasion, which has that happened about what, at least four, maybe five of the episodes?
It's quite a few. I mean, do you count Badgie? Because that's almost another one in a way, right?
You might, and he gets another appearance here. Is this the last we've seen of Badgie? He seems to be destroyed at this point, but who knows with regards to like programming, right?
Yeah, I mean, how many times did it seem like we might have seen the last of Lore?
I also like how Peanut Hamper got kind of the ending that Lore did, where like just floating in space. I don't think this is the last we've seen of Peanut Hamper.
Is Peanut Hamper going to come back as some sort of V'ger-like entity?
Okay, yes. No, more like the whale probe from Star Trek IV.
What's the animal, though, they have to go get to communicate with it?
Well, elephants, you know, because of peanuts, you know. So.
Okay, of course. Why did I think of that?
Yeah, she had a great line, though, when she beamed out of this situation where she was just like, sucks to be organic.
Well, I loved how they set that character up, too, as being incredibly efficient in the med bay and, you know, having this relationship with Tendi and Tendi cheering her on. And then it's just a total jerk.
Yeah. No, that episode from TNG, I think, what was it, Quality of Life, when they introduced the exocomps, that was not a very good episode.
Isn't Quality of Life the one, isn't that the one with Loxana Troy's boyfriend, where he, like, has to commit suicide at a certain age?
I'm pretty sure it's not. No, I think that's a different one.
I think that's Half a Life.
Oh, I think that, yeah. I can understand the confusion. Yeah, no, I'm pretty certain the exocomps are in Quality of Life. But I like how, like, Lower Decks keeps reaching, like, to the bottom of the barrel and, like, finding references that everyone can like acknowledge and be delighted by, and almost redeeming like certain elements that just did not work at the time.
Well, yeah, and also making a character out of it. I mean, this character, Peanut Hamper, I mean, you give a name like Peanut Hamper, people are instantly going to remember that name. And that assigns a lot of qualities to that character. And yeah, you bring that character back in next season, in season two, people are going to remember that character, and it has an identity, which, I mean, a lot of Star Trek, you know, the ones that don't work, the alien species that don't work, or the characters that don't work, they don't have that well-defined personality that you can really hang on, you know, hang on to. And that's actually something I think that has also worked so well with the entire cast of Star Trek Lower Decks. You know, we were talking about how, you know, some of the supporting cast of Picard haven't grabbed us the way you kind of hoped they would. But I think this show was really smart to really have their four main cast members. And then, you know, the senior crew are periphery characters, but the main four we've spent so much time with that we've gotten to know them incredibly well, versus Picard, which was trying to juggle, you know, a sizable supporting cast while giving Patrick Stewart the lion's share of the screen time.
Well, let me ask you this. How did Shax's death work for you?
I actually thought it worked really well. And because I understood the logic of everything that was happening. It was funny. Like, they played it for a laugh in a way where you have that, like, hold, was it hang tight baby bear or something like that? But I understood what was happening. I understood why this character is sacrificing his life for the betterment of, you know, Rutherford. And I could not help but reflect on the death of Major Cornwell, or Admiral Cornwell, I should say, in the second season of Star Trek Discovery. And that was a moment. I liked it in terms of the performances we were getting, but logically, I think a lot of fans had issues with it. They didn't quite get why this character committed suicide in this way, or why they didn't do more to save her, versus the Shax one. I understood completely why it happened.
For me, I just wish they had given the character more substance leading up in the preceding nine episodes. I think that would have hit home to me more. I understand his motivation much more so than Cornwall standing behind the blast doors for some reason with a torpedo in the finale of Discovery Season 2. I do think that they did add a little bit of, you know, substance with regards to Dr. Tana apparently having a bit of a crush on Shax as well.
With her coital hooks.
Yes. Cam, is that going to go on your Tinder profile?
How disturbing would that be on a Tinder profile?
Maybe you'll find another Lower Decks fan out there. Just they'll get the reference. That's who you want to target.
If I'm not banned within about an hour.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing with Shax is such a simple character, and we had talked about that. I think we even maybe said a few episodes ago, like, I feel like we've seen the most out of the Shax personality we're going to get. And, you know, I remember conversations you and I had had about The Sopranos, you know, you referenced it earlier, about how that show always seemed to know when to drop a story beat or a character, because you ran the risk of exhausting it. And I feel like Shax only had so much to give, and the show understood that.
You're talking about the end of season 5 of Sopranos, right? The character I'm talking about.
Yeah. I know the one.
No, but the thing is, like, that character, no spoilers, but that character met their logical conclusion. And the fact is they didn't feel the need to jump over hoops to make him work when just thematically it doesn't work in the series going forward. And I think that's something that's a testament to kind of storytelling that I like. And I think Lower Decks is kind of respecting that as well.
I mean, with the way that Shax goes out here, you got 10 episodes of this show, you know, he pops up in the majority and we understand who that character is, what his thing is, and his exit. So he really had kind of a perfect beginning, middle, and end. I'm okay with this. Like, leave them wanting more. You know, I know that our guest last week, Taylor Ramon, was a really big fan of Shax. We don't have to sit there through the rough patches where we're like, boy, it doesn't seem like they're using Shax at all lately. You know, we kind of got the most and the best of Shax.
Well, here's the cynical viewer, though. Are they setting up Mariner to just take over Shax's role as chief of security?
I don't think so, because that
really
was initially
I thought. Okay, break it down for me.
Believe me, that was my first thought. is that they were going to go there. But I don't know. I feel like the answer to that is probably no. And they were leaving it hanging so they could, you know, obviously decide if they wanted to create a new character for season two or a legacy character or whatever. I don't think you're, just because of the setup of the show is this Lower Decks show, I have a hard time believing they would put Mariner in that position. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I kind of feel.
You're 100% wrong, though. I think they were like really telegraphing hard, especially when we look at the parallels between Mariner and Boimler. Boimler has taken the promotion. He's now Lieutenant Junior Grade. And we do, when we're back at that space station and the Cerritos is undergoing repairs, we have that moment with Freeman and with Mariner in which Freeman says, look, I need somebody who's not always willing to fill or go forward with the rules. I need somebody in that role. And just a second earlier, she had said like, oh, I need somebody to fill in for Shax. I think they're being very, very clear that it's now up to Mariner to take on that role. She's going to be running in parallel with Boimler moving forward. And I think she's going to be Lieutenant Junior Grade when we come back for season two.
Do you think her on the bridge running security lasts? I don't. I think this might be like a one or two episode thing, but I don't think this is going to be a lasting, you know, spot for that character.
I still disagree because I get the sense that they don't want to be static with these characters. So we had that discussion the other week, though, about whether or not this is going to be a crew of perpetual ensigns. I don't think so. I think they're signaling that just narratively with where they're going with these characters. I don't think Boimler is destined to be serving on the USS Sacramento for all of season two. I think he'll inevitably come back over to the Cerritos. And I think it's going to be a weird situation, a potentially funny one, though. But if, say, Boimler is the Lieutenant Junior Grade and Mariner is the ensign, that could be funny. But I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think they're on parallel tracks in terms of their ranks and emerging beyond just being in the Lower Decks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you're 100% possible that that's the case.
Cam, anything's possible. Possibilities. I'm into what's likely. And I'm thinking of it based on what's most likely based on what the writers are doing and what the writers are telegraphing to us just narratively.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it would be somewhat insulting, too, if we just return everything to the status quo after the season premiere of season two. So, I mean, I'm all for this. Like, I'm not arguing against that I don't want this to happen. I still wonder if they like the idea of, I mean, and I'm all down for character development as well, but I wonder if they're still going to like the idea of, you know, this Mariner character is being a little bit of an outsider still. I don't know. Like, will this sort of temporary peace with Freeman last? I don't know.
I would get aggravated if we just have the character running in place. And I don't get the sense that that's what these writers want to do.
Well, and also, you know, I talked about how with Shax's death, that the writers seem to understand maybe when the best time to drop a character was or, you know, move on to something new. And maybe that will be the case. That completely works for me. I'm still struggling with whether I believe that just because this episode had a lot of movement for the characters and their world, whereas I would say the previous episodes didn't as much. We definitely got, you know, character growth in the relationships, but not significant growth like this. And so I'm just wondering if the show wants to do that or if it will, I don't know, find ways to not necessarily hit the reset button, but kind of restore the core concept of what the show is of these Lower Decks characters.
Well, you feel confident. I feel confident. Time will tell when season two comes around, which hopefully will be in the next couple months. I don't know, because speaking of that, like, okay, so we've got like Star Trek Discovery season three, and then after that, there's nothing filming for Star Trek. And I think if CBS All Access is rebranding as Paramount Plus, they're going to want to have new content. The thing that might be available, though, it'll be Star Trek Lower Decks because they've been continuing production because it's animation. So in this case, so I think it might actually like it might not be summer of 2021. It might actually be maybe, I don't know, spring or so. Like that would be great for us, at least.
Yeah, because I don't know what else they're going to do because Discovery will go off the air season three, you know, in the next, 3 months or something like that. And then what? You know, I mean, I don't think they have any short treks in production or anything. They may take a little bit of a break, but I don't think they're going to want to take too long a break because they want to keep the Star Trek brand going. So Lower Decks makes a lot of sense. I mean, we'll talk a little bit about Prodigy later on, but I guess that's the one thing they do have.
I wouldn't count the short treks out, though.
No, I wouldn't either.
Like, they don't announce them, like, while they're filming them. So they're always kind of a surprise. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are some short treks that premiere, you know, sometime in 2021. And they would have been produced concurrently with Discovery. I know that introduces some complications with regards to, say, production schedules amidst this COVID-19 issue. I think the goal, though, is to get Picard filming early into the new year, which could possibly mean a summer 2021 launch. And I don't know. We'll have lots of content, but I think 2020 is going to be the high point for just the sheer quantity of content that we're getting from the Star Trek universe.
One of the few positives in 2020 is more Star Trek.
True. That's very. Will we ever get a movie given the green light, though, in this year? I don't know.
It seems like they just don't know what to do. Like, they're kind of in paralysis mode with Star Trek movies. And I don't know. Do you care that much, given how much Star Trek, you know, TV we're getting?
No, I prefer Star Trek on TV over the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the only reason to really be pulling the trigger on movies is because they want that mass audience in a theater, you know, kind of money. But right now, that's not even a concern right now is theaters. Who knows what's going to happen there? So I don't know. And I just don't even know that Star Trek will be a big force in Cineplexes when theaters do reopen, given the way things are going to go. I mean, I think it's going to be a lot of very safe franchises for quite a while.
If I'm Viacom, Paramount, or whatever they're calling themselves now, I think the smartest thing to do, if you want to, you know, go big with your rebranded streaming service, greenlight the Quentin Tarantino script treatment, get that going, and just do like a straight to streaming movie. Like, that'll draw attention. Like, Quentin Tarantino fans will inevitably watch a Star Trek movie that has his name attached to it. It's going to generate interest no matter how good or bad it might be.
Yeah, because when you have this rebranded network kicking off, the announcement of Picard season 2 doesn't have the fireworks attached to it that a Tarantino adaptation Star Trek movie would.
No. What'll be attached to it is just tears from the people that have already watched season 1.
Yes, well, that's true enough.
Can I get into some more of the minutiae? This is the stuff that I can't help but think about, but the uniform situation during this era, right after Nemesis, and we did have that flashback to Mariner where we see her in the First Contact era uniform with the First Contact era comm badge, and that's what Riker, Troy, and the rest of the Titan crew are all donning. And we have, it appears that anybody who is on a California class or a Parliament class starship, they're all wearing the Lower Decks sort of uniforms. I don't have a problem with this because we've seen just a mishmash of different uniforms that cross over throughout the eras. What's your take on kind of like the discrepancy between uniforms?
I mean, I feel like the ground was kind of laid for this with having the Enterprise crew in the classic TOS uniforms, you know, when Pike showed up, and having the Discovery crew in the Discovery uniforms.
Yes.
So it was like, okay, fair enough. You know, we have different uniforms at different times. That's fine. I don't know that I have a strong opinion. I guess visually it's actually quite interesting to look at, and it actually does a lot of shorthand visual storytelling for you when you can just cut to Boimler in a different uniform and you understand what ship he's on.
Well, why? Okay. So why is the USS Sacramento, or the SAC as Boimler calls it, why are they in those uniforms? Because the reason I bring that up, though, is because the Sacramento, yet another California city. We have the Cerritos and the Solvang. I'm guessing that the Rubidoux is a California city as well. But those are all with the Lower Decks uniforms. But in the case of the Sacramento, it's now the First Contact uniforms. And so I would have assumed that the Sacramento was also a California class starship.
Yes, one would think. I have absolutely no idea what the explanation is. I mean, this is going outside of canon, but I remember there was in the first Discovery novel, they said it was different classes of ships used like different uniforms. And I don't know if that's what this crew, you know, what this, you know, creative team is going off of. That's just all I have to even try to even logically explain it to myself.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Beyond the ship stuff, I'm just curious about kind of the design of the bridge of the Titan. Like it really, really emulates what we saw with the Sovereign class starship, the Enterprise E. It's got the wood paneling as well. It also was distinct from what we saw with all these California class starships that have been dotting the landscape for the series.
Yeah, it looked great. This show is putting so much more effort into its ships than, you know, the famous Picard wall of cloned ships that we saw in the finale. Yeah. I mean, just the specifics of the inside of the Titan, it looked beautiful. I could watch an entire episode set on the Titan. Who knows, maybe we'll get that one day.
It's possible. It's possible.
A whole half hour with Madman Riker. I'm down for that. And his was that a Kelpian first officer?
I don't think so. Remember, it was what do they call him? They call him like Leonard or Leonid or something like that. But he was the guy who sneezed on everybody in the premiere of Discovery season 2.
Oh right. Oh, okay. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, I was looking at it because sometimes the translation to animation makes them look a little off, and I was trying to determine if that was a Kelpian or not.
You and I were confused about the Rigelians a couple weeks ago.
True enough. Yeah. And I would like to see more Kelpians in the actual larger Star Trek universe in this timeline, because obviously we've seen them on Discovery, but we haven't seen them yet show up in, you know, Picard or something like that.
Yeah. So, look, yeah, I totally think that could be fun. Okay. You're talking about like the possibility of a USS Titan spinoff. What about the legacy of appearances of Riker and Troi together on screen? We got them with this. We got them with Nepenthe. We got them with, unfortunately, These Are the Voyages. We also had the Riker genome appear on Voyager, and Troi later appeared as a guest star multiple times on Voyager. How do you rank all these legacy appearances from that particular pair of characters?
Okay, I'm going to give Nepenthe number one. I think that was the best, and I actually think Troi had far better material there than... I think Troi's fun here, but she doesn't get the like dynamite material that, you know, Riker does.
Well, we haven't had to hear about how she lost a child at this point. Yeah, you know? Thanks, Picard. Right. That's not depressing to think about.
But I mean, that episode gave Troi amazing material. Like that, we can say what we want about Picard. They actually wrote Troi fantastic stuff to do in that episode. So to me, that's number one. This is number two for sure. Let's see here. And then was there two others or three?
Well, we had These Are the Voyages. That we can put that at the bottom of the list, right?
Yeah, that's the easy bottom one, yeah.
And then what do you think about, like, they never appeared together on screen or in the same episode, but we did have Riker appear in Death Wish, and we had Troi later appear in Barclay arc. I also just want to correct myself. I refer to the Riker genome appearing in Voyager. It's actually the Riker genome that appeared on Star Trek Deep Space Nine with Return of One Tom Riker.
Oh, of course, right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but what do you think of the Voyager appearances with those two?
I think Death Wish is probably my third placer, and then the Troi, you know, Barclay scenes, which are uncomfortable.
Yeah, that is weird stuff. So
yeah, I like nothing against, you know, Marina Sirtis, who, you know, showed up, did her job to the best of her ability, but those scenes are a little weird.
Yeah, and I just, it felt as if something was off with how they're writing both those characters, in that, like, There was no growth over the last like 10 years.
Yeah, there's more growth showing up in Lower Decks sometimes than there is in these, you know, classic Star Trek shows.
Sometimes.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Cam, I know your taste in food. Did you retch when they made reference to a First Contact Day salmon?
It's true. I'm not a big fish fan. I'll eat tuna, but that's about it. I didn't retch, but I thought to myself, I would not be having First Contact Day salmon, and I won't be doing it this year.
Why is it First Contact Day salmon?
I think the joke is because it's such a, it's just a bizarre way to say that. You know, because, you know, you say Thanksgiving turkey, for example.
Okay.
They attach salmon to First Contact Day. So I'm like, okay, that's the thing, I guess.
First contact happened in, like, rural Montana. What does salmon have to do with it?
I have absolutely no idea. What would be, I mean, what's a better food to celebrate First Contact Day?
Boar.
I mean, let's be honest, though. Let's actually, boar. But let's look at this logically from the world of Star Trek. They're celebrating the first meeting of the Vulcans. To the what I've seen, Vulcans are vegetarian. So probably it should be a vegetarian food.
Pine cones.
With sauce.
Yeah, sauced pine cones.
Yeah. Speaking of Vulcans, were you as enchanted as I was to see the Spock helmet show up in Mariner's Contraband?
Okay, I'm so glad you brought this up because I've got a story to go along with this. Do you remember a couple years ago, there was like that comic book convention in Vancouver I dropped in, and while I walked by one of the vendors' tables, I was texting you in real time because there was one of those Spock Kirk helmets for sale.
Yeah.
And I inquired how much it was going for. The vendor said $100. You said that's an amazing price. And before I could do anything, somebody else bought it. This is all within, I would say, a 2.5 minute window. So that helmet is something to behold because for those that don't know, I don't know if you've seen it before, but it's literally just a helmet with a siren on it. And it has the words Kirk on one side and Spock on the other side. And it makes absolutely no sense. But the reason is it was actually originally a toy for like some, I think these were like army men or something like that. And then he just rebranded it with Star Trek stuff. And it had nothing to do with it. It is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, that was sort of the history of Star Trek toys. There's actually an episode of The Toys That Made Us on Star Trek figures. Really worth checking out if you haven't seen it. But
yeah, go to Netflix, folks.
Yeah, there was a lot of demand for Star Trek merchandise and they didn't really have anything going. So they just started snapping up pre-existing brands and relabeling them as Star Trek things. So there's also another helmet you can look up. I don't remember the name of it, but it's yellow and it has these weird, almost like Kelpian eyes on it or whatever. It looks weird. Very weird.
I'm shocked to find out that would look weird to you, but hey, Cam, I know you floated it in the past. I've always shaken my head. I didn't really believe you. I didn't think that there's any sort of traction going here. But do you still honestly think that Wolf 359 was an inside job?
Also, that the Dominion War never happened?
Changelings aren't real, bro.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a shot at, who is it? Bob Orsi, who is a 9/11 truther, and he also wrote the first two JJ Star Trek movies.
Oh, I did not make that connection. I thought of more just the modern trend of people inventing facts out of thin air and then insisting they're all true.
No, Cam, there's a spooky YouTube video with ominous music that plays while you watch it, so that proves everything.
Oh, God. And so, like, I thought, oh, this is very timely, given, you know, a lot of the conversations going on surrounding the election. Very timely joke. But you know what? That Bob Orsi story was boy, that really does feel... yeah, you know what? If you look into the history of Star Trek Into Darkness, listeners, Bob Orsi, you know, after that movie came out, was very vocal on Twitter about... And he co-wrote Into Darkness, as well as the 2009 film. He was very vocal about 9/11 conspiracies and just a lot of conspiracy stuff. And that's about the time his career seemed to kind of go quiet.
Yeah, I don't know what the biggest project he's done since then.
Maybe some TV stuff he has his name attached to or whatever, but I don't know. I did hear his name fairly recently, and I don't remember why, but he was attached to some sort of franchise reboot or something like that. But I don't know if there's any movement whatsoever.
I remember when Alex Kurtzman was given the reins of the series, their writing partners going on like 20 years, Bob Orsi tweeted out like, I'll work for free just to be involved with Star Trek. And then other people tweeted back, I guess you know your worth.
Oh, jeez. I always thought, though, this must have burned him in a lot of ways, because Orci was the bigger Star Trek fan of the two of them. When they took this on, like, Orci was a diehard Star Trek fan.
Kurtzman didn't know anything about Star Trek, really.
No, he knew, like, you know, Wrath of Khan, some TNG, kind of the touchstones for, you know, people that have, you know, kind of a vague understanding of the franchise. But this was, like, Orci's dream job to do, like, 2009 and then Into Darkness. And, you know, he was trying to line himself up to direct what became Star Trek Beyond. It would have been a completely different script at that point, but he was lining himself up to try to do that. And the fact that his writing partner, once they split apart, takes over the entire Star Trek brand and is just cranking out all these different series using legacy characters that he loves. I mean, ouch.
Yeah, yeah. But it wasn't just him. It wasn't just Orci trying to write Star Trek Beyond. It was like these weird negotiation tactics where he was setting up that he would have to direct it as well. Do you recall that?
Oh, yeah. It was a real back and forth about what was going on, because you would get these sort of interesting directors that were kind of circling it. Like Joe Cornish, I remember, who did Attack the Block, was one, a name that was circling it. And then you would hear these kind of behind the scenes stories about Roberto Orci blocking these directors from getting in and doing the job. Like, it just seemed bizarre.
Yeah. And ultimately, I think the rumor is the movie had to do with Vulcans and a time travel device or something like that. I guess the studio are like, well, I don't know. What about that Scotty guy? I've heard he's written a movie. Let's him write the next one.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was pitched as like a three-way race for some sort of object between the Vulcans, you know, our crew, and then another alien race. I'm not sure if it was Klingons or what, but I'm sure that Paramount at the end of the day looked at it and said, like, whatever, start over, who cares? I don't think the, you know, top brass at Paramount were hugely invested in, you know, the Vulcans, you know, racing for a object or something.
The MacGuffin that we always have to deal with.
Exactly. Yeah.
One of the things I realized, though, it's just how similar I am to Rutherford, though. I don't know if you know this, but Cam, I have been permanently been stuck on sexy mode. Did you know that?
I don't know if our listeners knew that.
I think they could tell. I think like I just ooze sexy through the through these podcasts here.
Sure. Especially with the Bane impressions.
If you want my body and you think I'm sexy.
I am really curious what they do with Rutherford going forward, because, you know, he had all this whole headset ripped off. What does that mean for season two? Because, you know, we had talked in the last, I don't know, three or four episodes ago about how, you know, this character was set up as someone with these kind of faulty implants that would cause, you know, comedic hijinks to happen. And we got that a lot in this episode. But if they remove it, I could also see them finding something else for this character, because maybe that exhausted itself as well.
He reminded me of Data at the end of Star Trek First Contact.
Right. Yes, yes. You mean after the
flesh,
gas or whatever.
Is burnt off and he's at ops and he's just got like the metal plating over his face. I wonder if there's going to be a different looking Rutherford. But I honestly love the emotional moment of realizing that Rutherford has lost all these memories over the last 10 episodes. And it's up to Tendi to become best friends with him again. And she's excited about that prospect. Even them just remembering the T-88s, those scanners with the purple stripes or whatever from Boimler's Errant Arrow. Or was it Cupid's Errant Arrow?
Cupid's, yeah.
Cupid's Errant Arrow. But I don't know. That was a great callback, too.
Yeah, it was. And I again, this show makes you care about their friendships. And that's something Discovery has actually done fairly well as well. But, you know, that's something Star Trek at its best does, which makes you just care about the friendships between these characters. And I think the Tendi Rutherford stuff works really well. And I thought the moment in this one where you had Boimler saying, you know, he doesn't want Mariner to take the promotion because she's his best friend. And she's like, oh, shut up. And turns around and you just see kind of the smirk on her face. Like, these characters do care about each other, even if they are kind of jerks sometimes.
Well, that moment really worked well for me, and it actually made me flash back to the season 2-3 episode premiere of Deep Space Nine, in which they kept insisting to each other, the cast or the main characters kept insisting to each other, oh yeah, we're all a family now. Let's all get together and fight these Bajoran insurgents or what have you. And that always rang untrue upon rewatch, because, you know, as the series goes on, they're not all a big family like they were on TNG. It's more like they found individual family units within this giant station. And this rang true to me, this moment between Boimler and Mariner. Like, it was 100% authentic.
Do you think they'll ever work at building the friendships between, say, Tendi and Mariner or something, where we get these sort of moments between them?
Yeah, I don't think they want to repeat themselves. I think they want to kind of build up the other potential things that could go on. Just even the comedy, like, potential by having other characters interact with each other. Like, I can't imagine, like, Tendi and Mariner seem to be on, like, opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to just their patience for humanity as a whole.
Mm-hmm, they really do, yeah. And so, like, I think maybe with Boimler off the ship, we get some explorations as to the relationships, you know, Mariner could have with Tendi or Rutherford, which I'm really looking forward to. Again, like, I think this show's done a really good job. Not every time we've commented on something that could be getting stale, you know, because we you know, earlier in the series, we were like, boy, is every episode just going to split off Rutherford and Tendi and Mariner and Boimler? And it feels like they've done a decent job at mixing that up in the last half of the season, so much so that I don't feel like I'm just repeating the same kind of story arc every time. And I hope they continue doing that, really keep mixing it up and maybe work in some senior crew characters as well.
Well, I think this was a very busy episode, but one that seemed very balanced, especially when we look back in the early episodes. If we're looking at season one as a whole, I definitely see, like, by the time you get to the halfway mark from Cupid's Errant Arrow on, the show just seems to get into its groove. It has found itself. It knows, like, the comedy that works. It knows how characters work. And I think the storytelling just really taps into that Star Trek spirit in a way that's, I think, has been a little bit lacking from some of the other series.
Hands down, this is the second best first season of Star Trek, right?
After TOS, I think, yeah, you can definitely, for sure. You know, like, what we've discussed it before, like, what's closest, like, maybe Star Trek Voyager?
Yeah, so. I think maybe Voyager. Yeah, I think there's not a lot of competition. Like, I enjoyed the, you know, watching season one Discovery, but, like, it's tough to make a real argument for that one, given the whole, you know, the ongoing mysteries and everything that really don't hold water.
Oh, you mean like Voke's identity?
Or, you know, Lorca stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. As far as finales go, how does this work for you as a finale and maybe as even a season one finale?
This is one of the best of the Kurtzman era. Like, the only one that I would put it up against is the second season of Discovery finale, which... Again, they're kind of doing two very different things. It's kind of tough to compare them, but in a way, they're also kind of doing the same thing, which is the big action finale with the character moments sprinkled in. Discovery, for me, has the emotional highs, whereas I feel like the logic of the storytelling is better in this finale, but I don't know that I could really, at this moment, decide which one I really prefer over the other.
So you're not saying it's all about In the Hands of the Prophets from Deep Space Nine?
You know what? That's a good episode. I'm not going to crap on that one. Learning Curve's the one we crap on.
That's true. That's true. From Star Trek Voyager. Sure. Yeah. So, Cam, maybe I'll just a quick lightning round of things I really enjoyed through this one. But Mariner transforming into a professional. She puts her hair in a bun. We also have Dr. Tana refer to Shax as a Bajoran beef stick. We also have a shout out to Wesley Crusher, which is something I've been thinking about with the mother child relationship aboard a starship. Yeah, and I also just have to believe that this exocomp, they're not going to survive the synth ban in the Federation, right?
unlikely. Yeah, yeah. A couple things I had, referring to TOS as those old scientists. I thought that was pretty funny. Also, I appreciated the joke about when they're down on Beta 3, where they talk about purging people during the Red Hour. And, you know, the Red Hour stuff inspired the movie The Purge. So it was kind of a very clever little reference there to that film franchise. So I appreciate that. Also, I just really love Riker screaming like, Carol!
Oh, the other funny moment, I can't believe I forgot about this, though, was when Boimler was making fun. Well, he made the reveal. We didn't touch on this. He revealed accidentally to the entire crew over that comm badge gag, which I thought was great, that's Mariner and Freeman are mother-daughter. And, of course, he's beamed to the bridge going like, oh, does Captain Mommy give sweet little Captain kisses? Like, I was cracking up when I was watching that.
Well, and also his frantic, like, oh my God, and then cut. Like, I love when they do those kind of quick cuts. It reminded me actually of the ending of Spider-Man Homecoming, where you have, Aunt May walk in and realize he's Spider-Man and just go, what the, cut to black. Like, I love those kind of abrupt cuts to credits.
Yeah.
You know, if done right, they can be very funny.
Yeah. Mr. Smith, do we want to do a little bit of a Star Trek Prodigy talk?
Yeah, let's go for it.
So it's just been confirmed that the show star is Kate Mulgrew. Did I take away the right information from that?
That seems to be the case, yes.
And she's starring as Captain, not Admiral, but Captain Catherine Janeway?
That is correct.
What do you make of that?
I have no idea. This is so bizarre, and I never would have seen this coming. I mean, I guess it makes a lot of sense to ground it with a legacy character, but I don't know that that ever occurred to me as the way we would see Janeway next.
No. we talked about her making an appearance in maybe Star Trek Picard or something like that. Okay, look, it's giving me one more reason to tune in to Star Trek Prodigy. You and I, we weren't sure if we could do, you know, like week-to-week episode reviews of a children's show. I'm still not convinced that can be the case. I think you and I were more set on the idea of like maybe we'll do like groups of reviews. Like we'll do three episodes at a time and then wait a couple weeks. But if Janeway's on the show, she's offering guidance to people. She's also like a strong female figure to a lot of young people, which I she's the captain that I grew up with. Like I started watching Voyager from episode one at age, I think I was 10. At the time. So I can totally relate to other kids like growing up with her. I'm intrigued by Star Trek Prodigy even more than I was before. We'll be tuning in.
What kind of timeline do you think this is set in? Because how many years are there between, you know, when Voyager gets back in Nemesis?
I think it's like 3 years, maybe two. So
not much.
Not so, which is fine. I mean, like one season does not necessarily equal 1 year. So it could just be she's giving guidance over the course of a month per season or over the course of 6 months per season. I don't know. Like I it could work, but it like you said, it is a very, very tight window.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, there is that episode of Voyager, which the name I'm blanking on, where she has the young crew members that they go on that little mission. Is it called like The Good Shepherd or something? That's a movie. There's a movie called The Good Shepherd, but wasn't the episode called something like that?
Yes, it's about how she established the CIA right after World War II, Cam.
No, Tyler. Section 31.
Oh, okay. No, yes, it is called Good Shepherd. That was the Voyager episode, as well as the Matt Damon movie.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay. So yeah, like we've seen Janeway mentor young people before, as well as some of the stuff with Kes and Seven. So like, I think it sounds like a great idea. I'm just really curious, is this set before Janeway wound up in the Delta Quadrant or what they're going to do here? Because
I think the Voyager was her first command, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm just fascinated. I mean, the thing with Prodigy was I was very excited to see maybe more of a straightforward Star Trek animated show, maybe a little more in the spirit of the original animated show, which obviously wasn't, you know, the comedy that Lower Decks is. So that had me excited. But I also thought it would be a little bit kind of off to the side, kind of like, a kids animated show that has canon elements, but doesn't necessarily require the attention of people who are watching, you know, Picard or Discovery or whatever. But like the existence of Janeway in this really does, even if those people don't necessarily appreciate what the show does, it makes it kind of appointment viewing, at least initially.
Yeah. Do you think tonally it's going to be more like Ephraim and Dot or more like The Girl Who Made the Stars? We're talking about the animated Short Treks that premiered last year.
Oh, that's a really good question. I would honestly prefer something like Ephraim and Dot, but I just wonder the character of Janeway has a real like gravity to her.
Yeah.
And I just, and there's an actual episode of Voyager called Gravity, I believe, but
it's not a good episode.
No, it's not. But it's kind of like, you know, asking, would you put Picard in a wacky sitcom Star Trek, which you go, well, that's not really those character or that character's strengths. So my guess is that this is going to be more of, you know, the girl who made the stars type of storytelling.
Wait, 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 Cam, are you saying that Stardust City Reg, in which we got to see Picard do a French accent and wear an eye patch and a beret, that's not comedy right there?
Well, not maybe for the right reasons, but okay. Yeah, like it just feels like the Kurtzman crew, I think, have been smart in when they bring back legacy characters, knowing what kind of stories to put them in so it feels like it serves the characters. So I feel like if they're looking at Janeway, they're probably not going to toss her into something that's sort of a, you know, like a musical comedy like Ephraim and Dot.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's probably going to be more likely in the vein of Girl Who Made the Stars. One of the questions we debated, I think, for far too long, which is something that we're wont to do, but kind of the three sort of initials that every Star Trek show gets, you know, Star Trek Picard is STP, Discovery is DSC. We were debating what Prodigy might be, whether it's Pro or PDG. Lower Decks, I don't see any fans really referring to it as, say, LDS. It's STLD, right?
Yeah, I see LD everywhere.
LD, or so that's even two. Yeah. It really has kind of gone against that grain when it comes to adopting inevitably sort of a three initial or a three character sort of name. Like they even made a reference to TOS in the finale.
Yeah. And I mean, the LDS thing made complete sense, but I wonder
if you're
if
Mormon.
They should...
Yes.
I wonder if they should have pushed LOW or something. Like, I feel like it just connects in the brain of people in the way, like when you say LDS, I feel like the S jumps out as weird to people.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. LOW could have worked, but I think, yeah, LD, STLD, those are kind of that what seems to have been adopted by the fan community.
Yeah, it's always interesting how obviously the showrunners and, you know, the people behind Star Trek do their best to come up with these acronyms that they think will represent their shows. But ultimately, often case, the fans decide what it'll be in the long haul.
Yeah. And you know what? If anybody doesn't like our opinions, do you know what I'm going to do, Cam? I'm going to feed you to Armus.
Hey, we got an Armus shout out. I predicted maybe the Wind Dancer, but we got Armus.
A question for you. Did Jonathan Frakes accidentally mispronounce Boimler's name or purposefully mispronounce Boimler's name as Riker?
Well, we've had a few characters mispronounce Boimler's name, so I think this was just continuing that joke.
Because he's been called Bumford before, which I thought was great. It sounded more like Frakes called him Bumbler or Bumler or something.
I heard, both times I watched it, I heard different things. So I heard kind of like Boomler, and then I heard Bumler. So I don't know.
Okay.
What I feel like is there was something on the page and Frakes kind of mangled it just a little bit so that it's very tough to pin down exactly what it's supposed to be.
That's what I thought as well.
Yeah, which completely works. I'm sure when they heard it, they were like, that's funny. Keep it.
Well, I thought his nickname as director was Two Takes Frakes, but apparently they only gave him one take for this.
Or he did it and he just walked out. Mr. Frakes, come back.
Krusty the Clown when he did the recording for the talking doll.
Yeah, okay, we're ready to record now, Krusty. So we should just let the listeners know that oftentimes when we, you know, wrap up a season of Star Trek, we have some space after the season is ended to talk about, you know, do, you know, a couple episodes later, do kind of a wrap up on that season. But because Discovery is starting so quickly, not going to be the case. So what we're going to do next week is we'll talk about the premiere of Star Trek Discovery, break all that down, but then give our episode rankings of Lower Decks at the end. It's kind of a happy medium, I guess.
So if you're not a fan of Discovery, but you're a fan of Lower Decks, one more reason to have to subject yourself to listening to us next week.
That's right. Can you believe we're already jumping to Discovery?
This whizzed by so quickly, just these last 10 weeks. So, and look, it's been 18 months since we saw any bit of Discovery. So I'm very excited for the new season. But Cam, I've been talking to you. I'm going to be a little less patient with Discovery in the early goings than I have in previous years. The show should know itself by now. And some of those, you know, That reliance and, say, mystery box stories, I'm just not going to give it the leeway that I used to.
What is the burning, Tyler? What is the burning?
I unless it's like some sort of like hint with regards to Michael Burnham's name, you are the burning Burnham. Like, that's all I can like muster for enthusiasm with regards to that sort of mystery. I just, if you're going to do a season-long mystery, don't make it a boring mystery. And that's what they keep doing with Picard and Discovery. And it's just like, okay, now I know the answer. Guess what? I don't care that much. And when I go back and rewatch it, I don't think I'm going to get that much out of it.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen a lot of criticisms of Lower Decks for not having these mysteries.
Well, here's one criticism. Whatever happened to that celestial sort of like being that went into Freeman's comm badge in episode 2?
Wouldn't it be awesome if that was a joke that neither you or I understood, but everyone else thought was hilarious?
That's true. Okay. Yeah. It wouldn't be the first time.
No. Okay. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Let us know what you thought of season one of Lower Decks. We'd love to hear it. Okay. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Cam, we just talked about it. We're doing Star Trek Discovery season 3 premiere. It'll be a blast. We're both looking forward to it. You don't need to ask me a third time at the end of the episode.
Sorry, it was my temporary amnesia.
Okay, Rutherford.
You can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in violent packlet attack, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R as in ransom's hard on me, EPORTON.
Okay, so until next time, with Discovery, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.